Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night forever. And you know that she's half crazy.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Mo Davio, author of the new novel Epic and Lovely from West Virginia University Press. Mo's debut novel, Every Anxious Wave, was a finalist for the 2017 Oregon Book Award. She's also a solo performer, having appeared at storytelling shows such as Bedpost Confessions and the Soundtrack Series. A graduate of Smith College and the Helen Zell Writers Program at the University of Michigan, Mo now lives here in Portland, where she works as a bookseller. And she was a DJ on college radio, which I can't wait to talk to her about. 2025 Oregon Book Award winner Kimberly King Parsons calls Epic and Lovely full of tenderness, dark humor, and aching vulnerability. Mo Davio has written a stunning novel that asks how we choose to be remembered when our stories reach their inevitable conclusion. The book is a meditation on inheritance, both genetic and emotional, that deftly explores what it means to leave behind a legacy when time is running out. Mo will be launching the new book in conversation with Tracy Manister at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village on Thursday, September 4th at 7 p.m. Please join us now for our conversation with Mo Davio, which is already in progress. Well, Mo, while reading your bio, I have to say one thing that caught my eye as someone with a passion for radio. Mm-hmm. You were a DJ on the Smith College radio station WOZQ when you were a student there.
That is absolutely correct. And it was probably my favorite part of college was being part of WOZQ. Do you remember the night of the Oscars in 1998?
Oh, no. What was the event?
Elliot Smith was nominated for Best Song for Good Will Hunting.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, he plays a big part in your first book,
Every Anxious Wave. And that night, because none of the other DJs wanted to miss the show, I DJed for like 8 hours.
On Oscar night.
On Oscar night, I just played a ton of Elliot. And yeah, I was hardcore. I was really enamored with the indie scene and had been since I was 11 years old.
And you're in the right city for that now, huh? We idolize them here in Portland.
That's part of why I'm here. When I was 11, I lived in Fresno, California, and one day I discovered the Fresno State radio station, and that was absolutely life-changing for a too tall, nerdy 11-year-old girl who got bullied all the time.
Man, radios work that way. There's talk about people who, they grew up in some small town, and at night they're getting like stations from New York and Chicago. Mm-hmm. There's even a Lou Reed song, Rock and Roll.
Yeah. And this would have been 1987, so there was no internet yet. But I found KFSR, and I want to say thank you to whoever those DJs were back then who would take my phone calls and ask me I would ask them about music. That's how I learned about They Might Be Giants and the Pixies. And it just went from there.
That was a different time when, some stations were not as freeform, but the ones where they let the DJs play what they wanted to play, it's much different than a Spotify or an Amazon Music or an Apple Music, because that's all determined by algorithm based on your other interests, where a DJ is going to introduce you to new music you had no idea existed.
Right.
And it might click with you like...
Yeah. This was the era where all the girls my age loved New Kids on the Block. And I couldn't see it. I didn't think they were cute. I didn't like the music.
But... Oh, well, I got to ask you also for the WOZQ station ID DJ Mo voice. Mm.
This is WOZQ 91.9 FM, Northampton. I'm Monique, as I was known back then. you just heard
Elliot Smith.
Elliot Smith with
And
Angelus.
We're about to hear some more Elliot Smith.
We just got an amazing new album in called In the Aeroplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel. Yeah.
Wow, great. You've got the voice.
I do have the voice.
You're natural.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should go from the depths of radio to the heights of literature.
Yeah.
Your first novel, Every Anxious Wave, which came out in 2016, mm-hmm. was kind of a love letter to music.
Yes.
Especially the music that you love, the music right. of the 90s. And the title is a lyric from the song Kath by the band Sebado. Mm-hmm. So it seems a natural progression from your experience as a radio DJ, huh?
Yeah. How did I learn about Sebado? I don't even remember. Northampton, Massachusetts, where Smith is, was where Sebado and Lou Barlow were from.
Okay.
And he is actually famous among a subset of us indie chicks of that era for illegally living in his Smithy girlfriend's dorm room back in when she was a student. So, yeah, but I've been a fan of his for 30-something years. And it just, my friend Tamar chose that lyric as a good title, and I just went with it.
Oh, no, it's just perfect.
Yeah.
And I had to look it up because I don't really know Sebado's music
well.
But now I know the song, Kath.
Mm-hmm.
Now the book, that first book, Every Anxious Wave, has a sci-fi element to mm-hmm. it. The main character narrator is Carl Bender. He finds a wormhole in his mm-hmm. bedroom closet, so a little bit leap of faith.
Sure.
In fact, I was looking at a house that had one, but was... mortgage was too high.
Yeah. It's too expensive these days.
Yeah, I know. And the wormhole can take people back to the past, and as we find out, even forward mm-hmm. into the future.
Yeah.
And Carl has an engineer friend, Wayne, and he hooks it up to a computer, and they use it to commercial endeavor to send people back to see their favorite bands play. Mm-hmm. So you're combining time travel and music. Now, I don't know if you know this, but I had read a 90s novel, Glimpses, by Lewis Shiner.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually born here in Oregon, in Eugene. And the premise was doing time travel to rescue legendary lost recordings by The Doors, Beach Boys like Smile.
Oh, I did not know about this.
Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. And you have characters that use time travel to see favorite bands. But I kind of think music fans can relate to both concepts. You know, it's kind of almost wish fulfillment.
Sure. Yeah.
And time travel was kind of your way of getting there here.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the music is one thing and a big piece of it, but like personal nostalgia and regret sort of fuel the impetus to want to time travel in this book.
Yes, they go a little bit beyond just going back to see their favorite bands there.
Yes.
Both Carl and Lena is his girlfriend.
One of them. One of his girlfriends. Yes.
Right.
The most important of his girlfriends.
Right. Now, I read a few of your interviews for Every Anxious Wave when it was first published, so back in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the big question, Mo, then was what show would you pick if right. you could travel back in time? In every interview, and there were four or five, you chose REM's first show, mm-hmm. Athens, Georgia, 1980, when you were just a little kid, so you couldn't
right.
have been there. Now, almost 10 years later, after those interviews, has that changed? Is it still REM's first show?
I would still love to see that show. You know, I have a new answer, which I don't know if you've had a chance to see the Jeff Buckley documentary down at Cinema 21.
No, I haven't.
I don't know if it's still playing. I saw it two weeks ago, a week ago.
No, I've heard about it.
Yeah.
Another kind of legendary dead guy, musician like Elliot Smith.
Exactly. And so after I saw it, I went down a Jeff Buckley wormhole and I found a recording, it's the album Live at Chennai being the New York City club where he frequently played shows in the early 90s, where he very lovingly and reverently covers a song by his hero, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. And he starts to sing in Urdu, which is the language that Nusrat sang in.
Uh-huh.
And you can hear the crowd laughing for a little bit. But then it all dawns on them that, no, this is not a joke at all.
It's like an Andy Kaufman bit, huh?
No, he is very lovingly and reverently performing.
Oh, I know, but Andy Kaufman was, the audience laughs, and he's not going to go on with a whole Mighty Mouse song, but he does.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so I've been listening to that album always. Like, wow, I would love to be at Chennai that night.
And what was that, 1990?
93.
Oh, okay. Well, we got to set the way back machine.
Yeah, I mean, that was a year before I got to the East Coast.
No, it's so, such a great question to ask. And I'm sure you had readers share their choices.
Oh, it was a big topic of conversation. I mean, people who I met were eager to, I got emails from people being like, this is the show I would want to see. It's this very specific Grateful Dead show in 1978, like stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
That is, yeah, that's Wayne.
Yeah, I'm a Deadhead, so I know quite a few of the, you know, the shows that are kind of iconic.
Sure.
To the Dead, like 5877 Cornell.
Okay.
That's not my pick, by the way.
Okay.
But I was wondering if you remember some of the more common ones, maybe Grateful Dead.
Grateful Dead.
1977, 78.
Beatles.
And maybe a few of the stranger ones. Yeah, that was actually one of the ones I was considering for my list would be Beatles, probably in Hamburg or at the Cavern Club in Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, early Beatles before they were big, because, man, they must have just really been something to see live and just come out of nowhere. And here's these guys just in a small room and everybody is, what is this? It's
Will say the demographic who responded or who wanted to share this with me, overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly older than me. I'm about to turn 50 now. So
well, that's me.
Figure exactly. It was a lot of Beatles, Stones, The Who.
Yeah. What were the weird ones?
The weird ones. Beethoven, Mozart. That's weird, but
I know that was also one that's high on my list would be Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he premiered it May 7th, 1824 in Vienna, and he was deaf. So they played it and it ended and he was standing with his back to the audience and he thought he failed because he couldn't hear anything, turned around and they just loved it. Moments like that just seem to me, oh man, I would really like to see that.
Yeah. I don't know, Weird Al was on the list.
He's still around. But maybe not in his early days yet. Again, that element of surprise with the audience is something. Like when you see the first REM show.
Sure.
You don't know who these guys are.
Yeah. A lot of my friends who were fellow indie music aficionados chose like the Magnetic Fields show that we all went to in 1996 on our college campus because that just meant a lot to us.
Yeah. And some of the characters in there actually go back to shows that they were at and they want to see themselves watching the show.
Right.
So it goes a little bit beyond just time travel for the band. Now, you did an interview on Every Anxious Wave with OPB, and you mentioned you were like a lot of women, thinking you were expected to change yourself for other people. But after writing the book, something happened. You told the interviewer, April Baer.
Oh, yeah.
That made you, quote, a tough-as-nails girl to the day you die. And as long as we're talking about going back to our own past and the bands,
sure.
What happened that led to that transformation?
Oh, well, it's kind of the reason why I moved to Portland 11 years ago. I got involved with a Portlander, former Portlander from what I hear on the street, and got into a relationship with him that was ultimately very abusive in most of the ways. He never hit me, but, you know, we can go
verbally
down.
Abusive.
Verbally, emotionally, even sexually.
Gaslighting.
Gaslighting. Lied to my face. Seemed to be enjoying the pain. And I was diagnosed with PTSD after that. And
oh,
was
my God.
In really bad shape for years.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
What was the turnaround then? You just were determined, oh, I'm not going to let this guy ruin my life.
Yeah. Or he's not allowed to affect me this way. But it took time. It took
and a lot of strength. Wow.
I was, in therapy for 6 years.
Yeah. But I mean, that's incredible that you were able to do that. I mean, a lot of people just, they can't get out of that pit.
Right. So, I mean, that kind of like leads us into a discussion of Epic and Lovely.
Yeah, I did want to ask one more thing about, Epic and Lovely figures in this one. So this might be a good transition. Epic and Lovely is the new novel, which we'll be focusing on today. And that comes out in a few days on September 1st. And we talked about a few of your inspirations for Every Anxious Wave, including Sebado and the bands. And one of your objectives you had mentioned for that book was to write a feminist novel from the point of view of a male protagonist. That's Carl Bender. Mm-hmm. And I think you accomplished that very successfully. Did the new book start with a similar objective or an object? I want to write a book with this narrator.
Both. both books are what ifs. So Every Anxious Wave is what if I could time travel and go back and change things I don't like or things I regret from my past. The what if of Epic and Lovely is very specific. Start there. I have Marfan syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder. So all the connective tissue in my body, especially my lungs and my heart, loose. I've had heart and lung problems my whole life. I'm very tall, and I have a very severe case of pectus excavatum, which is a giant crater in my chest.
Oh, my.
So so I have a deformity.
But it's unlike the protagonist in the book, it's not a visible deformity.
You don't, my deformities are not visible, like the ones that I gave to Nina.
Right, and she has a fictional...
She has a fictional version of Marfan syndrome, right. And I'll explain why I chose a fictional version and not Marfan itself. So when I was 18 years old, I've been going to the doctor for this for my whole life, but the year I was 18, the doctor said, don't ever carry a pregnancy to term because a full-term pregnancy will kill you.
Oh, and would the baby also get Marfan's?
No.
So it's just harmful to you as the mother.
It's just harmful because I can barely breathe and my heart is weak. Having a 9-month baby in me would probably severely cramp my ability to function. So I said, okay. And I put that in my pocket and I didn't have a baby, which was convenient because I didn't want one anyway. 20-something years pass, I go to the doctor again for this, and they ask me, as they do all women of a certain age, do you have any children? And I said, no, like, this is a Marfan visit. Like, what? I was like, no, I was told when I was 18 that I should never carry a pregnancy to term. And the doctor looked at me and said, oh, but you could have.
Oh, so they actually changed their medical advice on that?
Yeah, they did.
Wow, so there might be all those women who didn't have children who wanted them. And,
right.
And then... didn't even attempt it because they thought it would be fatal.
Right. And that, even though like that, I thought about how flippantly that doctor said that to me. And what if I had been someone who had been devastated by hearing that from a doctor? That wasn't me. I wasn't devastated. But it upset me for another reason, which was that was my excuse. I didn't have to explain why I didn't want to have children all these years. It can kill me. That's a great excuse.
Right.
That is a better excuse in our society than I just don't want to. Uh-huh. So.
And then you invented this disease that has some similarities to Marfan. It's called the H12 fibrillin deficiency syndrome, so vividly described in the book that I thought it was real.
Oh.
But I Googled it. I couldn't find
no,
much.
No, it's...
I could find the individual words.
It's not real. There's, and here's why.
Okay.
Marfan is a spectrum disorder, so some people have it worse than others. I have it. I'm a little on the easier, having it easier side of things. I wasn't really experiencing like severe symptoms regarding my heart and lungs until my 40s. That's not the case with everybody. And I wanted it to be specifically tied to paternal age. So my father was 65 when I was born. And although no doctor can definitively say for sure that my father's age at the time of my conception is responsible for me having Marfan, it makes sense.
Oh, okay. That's why with this H12 syndrome, it's usually passed down from fathers who are 60 years old or older.
Right. So it's a mutation.
And you also use that as kind of a satire on these rich old guys who marry younger women and then go ahead and get them pregnant.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's why I didn't use Marfan or Lois Dietz or
any
of the other.
So how did you come about? I know you've said in interviews that you didn't do all that much physics research for the time travel.
Yeah.
And you figured you can get out of that because the guy narrating the book was not a physicist, unlike his friend Lena, who was astrophysicist. So how did you go about researching this and making up this fictional disease that is so, it's so convincing to a reader?
I don't know that I did any research beyond all the research I've done on Marfan for my whole life.
Uh-huh.
It's just what I know about. It's in my body. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it or have to think about it. So.
And this fictional disease, they actually have physical deformities that are
visible.
Usually missing fingers.
Yeah, they have the calling card, as they like to say. There's a group of...
The Good Thumb.
The Friends of the Good Thumb are a gathering of... So, oh, also, Marfan doesn't necessarily kill you at age 40 the way that A12 does. Oh, so I wanted them all to have like an expiration date.
That's another...
yes, that's another
criterion. Well, criterion... it's another symptom of the
right.
disease. The fictional disease mm-hmm. is people who suffer from it don't usually live past the age of 40.
Right. So they're all around 40. All of them except for one are the children of older Hollywood men. And
One woman's dad is a famous jazz pianist.
Mm-hmm.
One woman's was he a horror movie director?
Horror movie director.
Vampire movies.
Uh-huh. One's the son of a Greek shipping magnate robber baron.
Oh, and that's right, Chris.
And an unnamed 70s American television star. And then one is just the last child of some very Catholic people that had babies very, very late.
Now, that 40 is interesting, too, because that's also the age of Carl Bender.
Yeah.
In Every Anxious Wave. And you were 40 when that book came out.
Mm-hmm.
Which was that kind of like a Gen X milepost for you?
Probably, yeah. I don't know.
You like the age of 40.
I like the age of 40. Yeah, you're right. I didn't really think, I mean, I was between 45 and 48 when I wrote Epic and Lovely, and I was 35 to 37, 38 when I wrote Every Anxious Wave.
Now, I wanted to take a little detour because the book itself is dedicated to somebody we both know, a really good friend of yours, Susan DeFreitas.
Mm-hmm.
She died...
6 months ago.
Yes, I think it was February mm-hmm. of this year. You're really sad from cancer, and he was extremely sad because she had just adopted a young child,
mm-hmm.
and you're dedicated to her, and you were good friends. And Susan, I think, well, she lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, but she's very much well known here in Portland,
right.
a very beloved member of the Portland literary community.
Mm-hmm.
And given the book's theme of illness and early death at the age mm-hmm. of 40, and Susan died at 47, I wonder how she influenced the new book. I know she was one of your early readers since you write in the dedication. The Scorpion was her idea.
The Scorpion was definitely
her
idea. Yes,
I want you to talk a little bit about Susan.
Susan DeFreitas was a genius. She was one of my good friends. I love her and miss her so much. And I think about her every day. I actually kind of cry a little bit whenever I drive past the street where I would turn to go to her house when she lived in Portland. She and I met in a writing group called The Guttery 10 years ago, and she was just the smartest. She just had like a certain eye for fiction and a certain ear for fiction.
Yes, she was actually doing a book coaching.
Yeah.
I would get her newsletter, her email newsletter, yeah. and extremely insightful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she taught. She published one novel called The Hot Season.
And I interviewed her for her anthology.
Yeah, and thank you for rerunning.
Dispatches from an Aris, which is a kind of other writer's tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for rerunning that after she passed.
It was really sad to listen to it again.
Because, I couldn't get through it.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that I had interviewed her, and she was so full of enthusiasm and for the book, for writing, for life, mm-hmm. and then, you know, all gone in a year or so.
Yeah. Yeah. So back in 2022, when I finished the first draft of Epic and Lovely, she was absolutely the first person that I wanted. And I hired her to be the developmental editor, and she read it.
This book needs a scorpion.
I don't remember what scene it was, but she, you know, lived in Santa Fe.
Uh-huh.
And there's a scene that takes place in New Mexico at a like a spa.
Nina kind of makes a run for it, and she's barefoot, and tell her, don't go barefoot because there's scorpions, and of course
she does. She gets a scorpion attached to her foot. And that was Susan's. She's like, you know, this is New Mexico, and we have scorpions, and let me just give you a little background about the small animals that Nina could run into as she runs barefoot to her car.
Now, you also said, I should mention that the book Epic and Lovely is written in the form of a letter from the main character, Nina, to her doctor, Tabitha Chen, who's an expert on this fictional disease, H12, fibrillin deficiency syndrome, or AFDS, as we like to say in the medical trade. Sure. And she's approaching 40, so she thinks she's also approaching the end of her life. Mm-hmm. It takes place in the current day of the book, which is 2022, with flashbacks, of course. Mm-hmm. So the structure itself is not simple. It's somewhat complex. But you said the first draft, Mo, came very quickly. I was wondering, how long did it take? Because some writers will say, 2-3 years for a draft, and then another 2-3 years for a revision.
10 months?
That's pretty, pretty quick. And then after that?
After that, I sent it to Susan.
Uh-huh.
Susan sent it back. And then I did some rewrites, and I sent it to my agent, Jenny Ferrari Adler, who I've been with since I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan's MFA program, and we went back and forth on it, and then it was done, or as done as it was going to be.
Now, we mentioned your father. You were born when he was 65, mm-hmm. and he died when you were 16.
Correct.
And your longing for him and wish to have spent more time together led in a way to your first novel mm-hmm. and the concept of time traveling back.
Yeah.
And the characters take full advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in an interview, you said, and I'm quoting, "I always sort of felt like the only way I could ever have a meaningful relationship with my dad was through time travel."
Yeah.
Now, I interviewed Lydia Yuknovich, mm-hmm. who's a wonderful Portland writer, Oregon writer. And she has a nice blurb for your book, too.
Mm-hmm.
She has a new memoir out, Reading the Waves. And in there, she writes about her second husband, Devin. He died in a tragic fall, or perhaps leap, from a construction crane. And Lydia says in the book that the sections on Devin were her attempt to write him back to life, quote, "even if it kills me, an impossible story." Do you feel you're trying to do the same with your dad in that first novel?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always trying to bring him back. Yeah.
Again, an impossible story, but one
story.
Worth telling.
Yeah. And one a little bit more blatantly in Epic and Lovely, around the time I was working on this, guys like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino were having babies into their 80s.
Oh, and Mick Jagger has one every 2 years.
Right, right.
he's in his 80s.
And, the media portrays it as like, what a triumph, or ew, age gap relationships are gross. But they never focus on like how this affects the child.
Exactly. You figure, okay, the child's in this a home of wealth and they're going to have a lot of good care and all that.
Sure.
They won't want for anything.
Well.
But maybe there's some health difficulties
right.
based on that.
I was like, well.
Usually a younger woman too, right?
Always a younger woman. Well, biology, but also, yeah, there's right. always a younger woman.
That's true. Right? Well, also guys like Mick Jagger don't marry 80-year-olds. I guess.
No.
They marry down.
Of course.
Another recurring theme in both novels is characters with unhappy childhoods,
mm-hmm.
Usually due to broken families and abuse or neglect by one parent or another. And that's mm-hmm. evident in both books.
Yeah.
Was that something you had to deal with? You had some experience with?
Of course.
But not from your dad's side, probably.
No. My mother married a horrible man when I was 14.
Oh, and there's a horrible man who marries Nina's mom, Tracy.
Yes.
Ex-quarterback Greg Hodges.
Yeah. Yeah, my former stepdad is not a quarterback, although maybe he thinks he is. What is there to say?
But Greg Hodges is somewhat modeled on your stepdad?
Kind of. Well,
a little bit. Oh, well, for legal purposes, we'll say not at all.
Yeah, he's not dead yet.
Okay.
So I've tried to
be. Are you still in contact?
No.
Oh.
No, I would never speak to my stepfather. Mm. He's horrible.
And you don't know if he's reading your books or anything like that.
I don't know. I don't care.
So,
yeah, it doesn't feel good to hate someone, but I hate him.
Well, I think a lot of people in those families do the same thing. And
right.
There's only two ways you can go. You can kind of. Like you had the PTSD.
Yeah.
And just live with that your whole life, or actually say at one point, this is no longer me.
Right.
Yet I'm going to separate myself from this cause of suffering and pain.
Right. But there's a line to be drawn between, that situation when I was a kid and my, choosing bad partners. Which is not to say I didn't get out of it. I'm now married to a wonderful man.
Oh, Tim.
Tim yes, Halvin. You know Tim.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. But yeah, like it's it haunts me every day that my mother.
Yeah, well one was kind of your choice and one was your mom's choice, and you
right.
had nothing to
I'm
do
not
with
even
it.
I'm not even mad at that guy anymore, my abusive ex-boyfriend. I'm really not. Like, he rarely crosses my mind anymore.
Yeah, and who doesn't have an abusive but, ex-boyfriend?
Right. Or, well, I hope not a whole lot of people.
I hope not, but I hear a lot about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean that so around the time I was healing from the boyfriend, that would have been like 2014, 15, 16. I was very, very much involved in the online narcissistic abuse community.
Yes, you have something on that on your website, some right? resources for people who are
dealing
with
individuals. Yeah, oh, I took that down a while ago, but yeah.
Oh, okay. I guess I read that in an interview and didn't check on the website.
Yeah.
But, can you explain what that is?
Well, it's unpopular to use the word narcissism nowadays.
Oh, why is that?
Some people believe that it is ableist to say that because narcissistic personality disorder is a real and tragic illness, and one should not throw that word just at a crappy boyfriend.
Oh, okay. So, but yet it seems something that is not totally determined by biology and genetics.
Right. It's, my feeling is that a lot of people are going to resist the word abuse, mm-hmm. and narcissistic sort of fills in that gap for people.
Or a sociopath.
Or sociopath. So I nowadays I just leap straight to abuse because that's accurate. Huh. But it was more socially acceptable in 2015 to
call somebody a narcissist.
Call somebody a narcissist, especially online. So I was part of these online groups, and I would read. It was really more like the pattern recognizing community, because it was like, this guy did this, and then this other guy did the exact same thing. Oh, this same thing. Like, it was cathartic in a way, you know?
And the main male character in Epic and Lovely is Cole, and he definitely has that.
Yes, Cole. Yeah,
very
Cole
full of himself.
Is grandiose, and I mean, part of me loves Cole. Like,
he definitely has, you know, he's a very rounded character, very 3D.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the question about characters changing names in the book.
Yes.
In an attempt to change their identity. Nina's father in the book was born with the very Jewish name Sandy Blattner, mm-hmm. and then changed it to the somewhat Goyish Eddie Plain. Goyish is not a bad word. So.
No.
It's basically non-Jewish, very non-Jewish, you know, people who put mayonnaise on their sandwich.
Of course.
And when he started making it big as a singer. And the book's anti-hero, this Cole, he was originally Nick Sullivan. He changed his name to Cole Korchen.
Korshane.
Korshane, yes. To suit his new chosen identity as a narcissist, I guess. But that desire to escape who they were is not really that successful, as we see in the book.
No.
They're still that person.
Right. Yeah. I've noticed, abusive boyfriend used a fake name professionally.
Oh, really?
Socially. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Because I just really love the attempt to change identity by changing your name.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of entertainers did that, especially mm-hmm. Jews.
Sure.
And in Hollywood, there's guys you'd never think were Jewish because of the name they took. Who was the, he was a 20s and 30s actor. Something Cortez, and he was born Jewish.
Oh.
And he kind of went into this identity on mm-hmm. screen as this Latin lover. was it Roberto Ricardo Cortez? Something like that. Yeah, I watch a lot of TCM.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't know about
yeah, him. So that's a kind of an extreme version of that. But a lot of the entertainers, including mm-hmm. Eddie here, when he was Sandy Blattner, he started in the Catskills and the Borscht Belt. Mm-hmm. And then to make himself more palatable to most of America, you know, he changed his name to Eddie Blaine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, at one point, Cole says, so the guy with the narcissist problem, mm-hmm. I'm basically Alibar from Jitterbug Perfume. And that's a novel by Tom Robbins, uh-huh. a very popular one. I certainly remember when it came out. In Robbins' book, Alibar, I looked it up. he's a powerful 8th century king who's subject to trying to kill him because he's getting too old, and that's what they do there. Mm-hmm. They kill the king when he gets too old. So that sets him off on this quest for immortality. Now, as somebody with this A12 syndrome, Cole is not projected to live much past 40. He's already, I think, 46 in the book. Mm-hmm. But he's also looking for immortality?
Yeah. I think that was just part of his grandiosity that he would not
admit
that he's as mortal as the rest of them, and that he, because he'd already cheated death.
What an incredible delusion. Yeah.
Yeah. He's, have you ever
Tom Robbins
spent
can get
time
away
with a
it.
Delusional person? It's, it can be fun until it isn't.
I'm getting from that you have.
Oh, yes.
Now, the primary relationship in the book is between Nina and this delusional Cole, Corshane.
Yeah.
Or Corshane?
Corshane.
Okay.
As they, it's a Quebecois French name.
Yeah, or, like, or the guy formerly known as Nick Sullivan,
right.
From this Irish Catholic family. Mm-hmm. And it's a very complex one, bordering on submission and dominance, including sexual.
Yeah.
Often to the point of sadistic cruelty, so beyond the pleasure of sex.
Yeah.
And Nina is very well aware of Cole's dark side. At one point she writes, "Cole was after all my death god. He was Eros and Thanatos in equal measure." Now her friends and family tell her Cole's no good, but she has this strong attraction, almost need to maintain the relationship. And she says, mostly it was that Cole, like me, was a mutant, a bent twig, a time travel baby. And because we shared those rare qualities, I could see in him my own story and my own beauty, which I loved, because it kind of, she's well aware of who he is, but she's still attracted to him. I was wondering what is one of the benefits of reading a book and talking to the author. One of the great privileges is asking a question like, what do you mean by time travel baby? It made me think of your first novel.
Oh, that is an internal reference to being the child of much older parents. Cole has a double whammy of that, where his mother was 50 and his father was 60 when he was born.
And that's why he ended up with A12 syndrome.
Yeah.
But he tries to, he doesn't really deny it. It's just,
no.
He almost kind of glorifies it.
Right.
Oh, there's one gruesome scene in the book that I won't even talk about, but where he has a non-A12er and he tries to turn her into somebody. With that affliction,
she apparently consented. I don't know. Well, I did write it, but there's a lot of lies in the book that only I know are lies that are coming from Cole.
And Nina, of course, is very self-aware, as I mentioned, and she has this line in the book: "I promise you that the only way to maintain your sanity at the end of your life is to always know who the villain in your story is, because when that gets murky, as it did with Cole, you fall in love with the wrong person, you'll live for a ghost, you'll die for a ghost too." And I think that speaks for a lot of people in bad relationships that they can't shake off.
I had a different relationship, not with the aforementioned Portland guy, a different guy. And after that relationship was over, I was like, that would have been really great if I had died at the end, which I'm sorry to be laughing. I guess that's just conveying my discomfort. But yeah, I think that's why I made...
Would have been more romantic?
Or... A12. No, because you don't have to have an aftermath.
Oh,
the relationship lasts 6 months. You spend 6 years healing from it. That's not a good return on investment.
Yeah, you kind of avoid the PTSD.
Right.
But you go right to the big D.
right.
Now, towards the end of Epic and Lovely, and I don't think it's giving anything away, Nina's in the hospital at Stanford Medical, and there's a beautiful passage after she's in pain, she's suffering, and she self-doses with morphine, those morphine drips they have. Mm-hmm. And she says, whatever was in that IV drip, Dr. Chen, her doctor who she's addressing the letter to, allowed me to do something I always wanted, time travel. And in this kind of morphine-induced dream, she goes back to when she was 7 and her father, Eddie, had just died and says, Nina says, the IV drip may have unlocked the part of my brain where the painful memories were stored. And I found myself reliving the old one where I was looking for my father and knew I'd never find him. And that not only reflects, I think, the time travel in your first novel, but perhaps your own sense of loss after your dad died.
Yeah. Yeah. That's been the number one story of Mo for 33 years.
Yeah, and that's something that, again, going back to Lydia's interview, she talked about her father, who was extremely abusive, until a time when he almost drowned, and Lydia saved him when she was young, I think in her teens, early 20s, from drowning. She said it was just in about knee-deep water. And the aftermath for him was he became a totally different person. He forgot all the abusive parts, all that. But Lydia said, you know, maybe he changed, but still all the effects mm-hmm. of what he did to me continue.
Sure.
And I think with that PTSD, that's even after the therapy and kind of helping yourself right. and living a life of less pain and suffering, it's still there.
It's always there. My life is great now. I have a wonderful, supportive husband, have a house. I love my job as a bookseller at Annie Bloom's.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that too.
But yeah, it's always haunted me. The evil stepfather haunts me more than the bad boyfriends ever do, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a child, I mean, you're much more vulnerable too, I think. So. Yeah, and man, to have a parent like that, even a step-parent, mm-hmm. It's just a betrayal of a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I don't have a good relationship with my mother because of it.
Because of that.
Yeah.
Now, we mentioned the two main characters of the book are Nina and Cole, but there are at least two others that stood out for me. Mm-hmm. One of them is Nina's dad, Eddie Blaine, formerly known, the singer formerly known as Sandy Blattner. And his career begins at hotels in the Catskills, the famous Borscht Belt, which was how many Jewish performers got their start. And when he speaks in the book, it's sprinkled with several Yiddish words and inflections. Actually, it's 100 degrees outside today, so I was thinking the same thing. I was going, man, I'm schwitzing out here.
You're schwitzing.
Schwitzing is
not
an obscenity, by the way. It just means sweat in Yiddish. You must have done a lot of research, but you don't do a lot of research.
I don't do a lot of research, Ken.
I'm trying to tell you.
So let me tell you, back in the University of Michigan in 2011, I was an MFA student with my favorite teacher was Eileen Pollack. I think maybe I'll stop the accent. Although maybe Eileen would love for me to talk about her.
I was about to go out for a pastrami sandwich.
I'll take you to Cantor's after
right.
this. Eileen was one of my great teachers at the University of Michigan, and I adore her. And she grew up in a family that owned a Catskills hotel.
Wow. Which one?
Don't remember.
My parents always used to talk about Grossinger's. That's the one that kind of.
I want to say that one was next door.
Okay.
That was the big one that kind of was more successful than her family's. If I really Eileen, where are you? Come on and tell us what the correct answer is. So that's sort of a nod to Eileen, who has written about that.
The Borscht Belt.
Yeah, the Borscht Belt.
Wow. And another side character that really came to life for me is Steve Elwood.
He's a
tech billionaire, which seems all the rage these days.
Sure.
And Cole's arch nemesis.
Right. I will say that Steve gives generously to medical research.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially fictional syndromes. Yeah, very. I think he gets a tax write-off for that.
He does. He and his 28-year-old wife.
And apparently he's also, like you, a fan of 90s music, as the characters in your first novel also are.
Yes.
And Nina always sees him wearing a Pixie shirt. He says at one point, I bought 300 of these in 1998. Frank Black himself, who was in the Pixies, asked me not to wear them in public, but he's not the boss of me.
Right.
So I just love that you get the 90s and the Pixies reference in the book.
Yeah.
Now, the book's not officially released until next week, but I looked under the Amazon bestseller rankings. Mm-hmm. It's already listed in a category called disability fiction.
Yes.
Which I didn't know existed.
It does.
I guess Catherine Dunn's Geek Love would also be in that, even though a very different kind of book.
I did think of Geek Love as a comp title to Epic and Lovely. It's too old for it to be an actual, like,
Yeah, and I think they're very comp. Different books.
They are very different, too. Yeah.
Now, H12 Fibrillin Deficiency Syndrome is your own invention. But did you feel a responsibility to get the disability part of it right so the characters who have H12 are not stereotypes, maybe run it by a disabled reviewer?
I did not do that, partially because I live with Marfan and it seemed
You didn't to need
be,
to.
I didn't need to. I don't live with severe Marfan, I will admit that. It's being advertised as a disability book, but my intention was to write about having a different body and being considered ugly, which is more thematically on point with what Nina is talking about.
Right. She considers herself ugly, except her father always told her how beautiful she is.
Right.
And Cole, even up to a point, does.
Yes.
Yes. Until he becomes the sadistic Cole.
Right. So... I have at various points in my life, even by my own family, been called ugly. So I think that is more the theme. But yes, it does deal with disability as well. Although A12ers in the book are more or less able-bodied till the end. Like, Nina's a baker. Like, that's a physical job that she could do up until, like, a couple years before we meet her. So.
And then, yeah, she's gradually, her body is, she's losing a lot of functions of her body when she's approaching 40 in that hospital suite in Stanford Medical.
Yes.
Yeah, everything's kind of breaking down.
She's also
her.
8 months pregnant and seven and a half. She makes it to seven and a half.
And again, I don't think that's a spoiler.
No, it's on the back of the book, and there's a pregnant woman on the cover. So,
right, and a lot of the descriptions I think mention that too.
Right. So she was told at age 18 never to carry a pregnancy to term, and then she did. Yay!
Now, I did read, taking another trip back in our time machine. So this is an interview you did in December 2017. Well, actually, it was a Facebook post.
Okay.
You made in December 2017.
Oh.
So about 8 years ago. You said in the post, I haven't been posting much. My second novel, Marcy Pillow, is in the can. I am working on a TV pilot script for a TV series about the Vermont artist colony where I spent most of 2017.
Uh-huh.
So again, very curious. The second novel turned out to be Epic and Lovely, the second published novel.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to Marcy Pillow?
Marcy Pillow died on submission. It got 40, my agent took it out in, what was that? Summer of 2018? Yeah.
What was the feedback you were getting from editors and publishers?
I don't remember. I've really let that one go. I'm actually kind of glad that Marcy Pillow is very structurally similar to Epic and Lovely, and it's more on the nose about abuse. So that was really like my post-abusive relationship novel. But
and
yeah,
you figured you tempered that down a bit in Epic and Lovely?
I did temper it down a lot in Epic and Lovely and made it about some other things as well. And then I just didn't finish that TV pilot, although I wrote a different TV pilot that I've not done anything about.
Which had nothing to do with the artist colony?
Right. That was about a record store in Northampton and my friend Karen Corday, in a fictional world, buying it and running it after, you know, being out of college for 25 years.
Ah.
But yeah, I have a lot of dead projects, Ken.
Are you working on a novel currently?
I am. This sort of ties in with being a bookseller because I see...
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask about
too.
So I figured, you're a bookseller at Annie Bloom's, which is this wonderful independent bookstore in Multnomah Village in Portland. And I figured that's got to be really helpful for a writer because you're seeing what people want to read and maybe even pushing, recommending some books and having people come back with feedback on
Sure. Sometimes it's kind of disappointing to see that there's the top bestseller books that tend to walk out the door every day.
And then they're not always the ones that you enjoy reading.
No.
Or maybe probably I don't either.
No. Everybody gets to have their taste, but a lot of taste is manufactured by publishers. Anyway,
oh, I've heard that over and over again. Yeah, because they have the clout to do that.
It's all made up.
Yeah.
Some are chosen, some are not. Anyway, so I started writing a romance novel. So I have a colleague who is very enthusiastic about sports-themed romance books. And I was like, what if there was an indie rock-themed romance book with middle-aged characters?
So let's go back. What's a sports-themed romance book where a baseball player falls in love?
You can come to Annie Bloom's and see Joanna, and she'll tell you the titles of all her favorite hockey romances.
Oh, she's the resident expert.
But she
specializes in hockey.
Yes. Okay. But I mean, we'll say pan sports here.
Okay.
So it's like... these two people meet playing hockey, and one's on one team and the other's on the other team, and they're playing against each other and they hate each other until they fall in love, like that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
It's just like, you know, the setting of the book has, there's different themes in the romance world. So I was like, what if?
Yeah, but kind of that format, kind of meet cute. Somehow you come apart, you're divided. There's a conflict, and then you come back together.
Yes.
Yeah, almost every rom-com is like that, isn't it?
Exactly. So what if a 46-year-old recent divorcee who's about to send her son off to college meets and starts dating her favorite indie rock star from 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah. And we should mention also in Every Anxious Wave, Carl Bender is an ex indie rock star.
Right.
Maybe star is too strong a word.
He's not in his band anymore.
Yeah, he had a band, Axis, and the lead singer went on to bigger and better things, but Carl just gave up music altogether.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that kind of 90s music romance, but there's a lot more going on in there, too.
Right. So, like, the reader I am looking to serve through this new book that I've been working on are the 40-year-old dads in band t-shirts.
40 again.
Right, 40-something, I should say.
Okay. And these bands are like the Pixies.
If a guy comes in a Pixies shirt or a Pavement shirt, I am all over him. I'm like, excuse me, sir, I need you to read Every Anxious Wave by Mo Davio. Don't look at the photo on the back. Oh, no, it's me. Anyway, yeah, I am.
I think they would love it, though.
Yeah, I did improv comedy for 12 years, so I'm very outgoing. And sometimes I'm a little bit of a used car salesman at Annie Bloom's, but I sell my own book.
That's so refreshing in a bookstore. Because a lot of them, I mean, you're just on your own in the stacks. And there's not a whole lot of people I ask for help. Not
concierge service, Ken.
Well, also, it's a small independent bookstore, so it's not Barnes & Noble.
Right. But yes, I do provide excellent recommendations, warm and enthusiastic customer service. If you're not into, like, the cloying sell, I will walk away. I can intuit that. So
has anybody then bought Every Anxious Way? Well, Epic and Lovey hasn't come out yet, so I hope you push that, because I think people will love it. But has a customer who bought the book and read it come back and told you what they thought?
Yeah. I've had lots of people come back. And be like, I bought your book and I loved it. And I'm like, thank you. It does mean the world to me to hear that. So even a book that's 10 years old now.
Now, not every guy that walks in there with a music shirt, a band shirt, is 90s music.
True.
There's probably people closer to my age who are wearing, like, Grateful Dead shirts.
Sure, I'll sell it to them.
Tie-dye.
Right. I generally don't sell it to, like, the young people or the elders, but everybody in the middle.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Epic and Lovely, we go back to Eddie Blaine's career. And he's like a 50s crooner.
Yeah.
Was Vic Damone mentioned in there?
Vic Damone is mentioned. Dino is mentioned.
Yeah, Dean Martin, of course.
Yeah.
And then even the song that his manager slash caretaker, Addy, wrote for him called Somber Mountain. So very different than the 90s music that was focused on in the first novel.
I think that's, I really like tried to use the language and the aphorisms I remember my dad using, because he was born in 1910. And so he's got a lot of like 30s and 40s. Like, I never heard my dad call a movie a movie. It was always a picture.
Oh, was it a moving picture?
Yeah. Motion picture.
Oh, yeah.
Pictures. So he would say, I hate Ronald Reagan. He made the worst pictures. He made pictures. Yeah.
The Bonzo series, right?
Right. He didn't
the chimp.
Like those.
No.
Right. So there's a lot of that. And I was like, I have the daydream, like, if I could have my dad back for one day, what would I show him?
Yeah, what would
about
you show him?
My phone.
Oh, okay.
He kind of predicted them. He said, someday you will carry a small computer in your pocket and have access to all the world's knowledge.
Wow.
And he died in 1992, so he never saw
that's amazing.
A smartphone. But
Yeah. Our kids, when they were in high school, we bought one of them, well, they're in the 30s now. So we bought one of them this Texas Instruments calculator at the time, which was very high tech. And my wife actually got it to work again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have a slide rule too, but I forgot how that worked. I had that in high school. And it's amazing to realize how advanced that was at the time. And now you've got, well, even my first computer, home computer, was a K Pro 2. And the phone in our pockets is much more powerful than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's incredible. But your dad kind of had his... How did he do that? Did he watch some of those old motion pictures?
He was just a really smart, cool, ahead of his time, born too soon guy.
Now, you mentioned, Mo, the improv.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I wanted to ask you about, I read in your bio that you did storytelling projects. Mm-hmm. You did some readings and storytelling shows, and it was mentioned Bedpost Confession and what was called a sex-themed storytelling show in Austin, Texas.
Yes.
As a storyteller, you tell them both on stage, or you did. Maybe now too.
Sometimes.
And on the page. Did you write some of the stories you told on stage, you performed?
Oh, yeah. I wrote all of them. Yeah.
That leads to my question then. So how would it differ between writing on the page and writing for an audience. Of course, with an audience, you get immediate feedback and you don't get that on the page.
I think for the stage, I write less. I'm more comfortable improvising, telling the story extemporaneously.
Wow. Kind of like a Garrison Keillor.
Just from all my training. Yeah. So I will have like notes, but like what I actually say is
Oh, that's a great talent to
verbatim
have.
And
you had that improv comedy background too.
I did improv in Austin for 12 years, I guess.
Does that help you when sitting down to write a novel?
Oh, yeah. Novels are improv in my head.
You're not getting writer's block or anything. I don't know where this is going.
You know, there's times like 2020, I didn't really write anything because we were all trying to survive.
Sequestered. Uh-huh.
And recently, I've not really felt terribly creative. Maybe it's nerves about this book coming out or I don't know. But it comes and goes. But yeah, I enjoy it. I can just jump on stage. There was a famous story, not famous, but famous to me, when I was in grad school at Michigan, where there was a tornado warning and we were having a reading in the basement of the art museum at the University of Michigan.
Oh, was that the tornado cellar or something?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So we couldn't leave. And I remember the director of the program, Michael Byers, pointed at me, said, "Mo, you on stage, entertain us."
Wow.
And I was like, okay. I don't remember what I told a story. I don't remember what I did. And then I encouraged others to
just an
to
improv
join me.
Story?
Yeah, I just improvised a story and I was like, okay, was anyone else want to do that?
Was there a tornado in it?
No, I don't remember what I said, but I do remember, I guess I had the reputation of having live storytelling chops.
One last question based on that, and that's, I figure just like being a bookseller, It kind of gives you a head up on other writers because you kind of know what people are reading or want to read.
I do.
Or what they enjoy once you recommend or suggest a book. Mm-hmm. And I would figure, I had mentioned kind of that immediate feedback you get on stage, and comedians talk about that all the time. Jokes that hit, that kill in comedian talk, and jokes that just kind of die where you're losing the audience engagement. Mm-hmm. That's got to help as a writer, doesn't it?
To kind of,
you know, where you're slowing things down a little too much, maybe too much description or something.
A good scene has, you know, a rise and a fall, an emotional tenor, and a switch and a change and a denouement. And yeah, like a good onstage story, a page story. Does ultimately the same work.
So it's great that everything kind of fits together.
It does.
Now, Mo, thanks so much for talking with us today. And thank you for your return to radio.
It's been so much fun.
Station
I've just
here.
Been staring at the board like, oh, I missed that.
Oh, I know. Well, I told you when we did a little tour before we turned on the mics of the station, I used to do, now it's all automatic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people send in their shows and it's just automatically played at the right time. But when I used to be in the air room doing live shows, there was nothing like it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Ken.
Oh. Well, great to see you. And I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Both of them.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Wait. Hold off on the closing music. We're not quite finished. Mo and I had such an engaging conversation. I forgot to ask her two questions that were in my notes. I only found out after our interview and really wanted to know the answers. I emailed Mo and she graciously agreed to record her replies with the assistance of her husband and audio engineer extraordinaire, Tim Halber. I'd like to play them for you now as sort of bonus material. Here goes. Mo, we talked about the title for Every Anxious Wave. It's a lyric from the Sebadoh song Kath. Why did you pick Epic and Lovely for the new book, which sounds like it would also make a great song title?
So this is kind of a downer story. In 2020, when lockdowns were announced, I was all alone in an apartment in Austin where I had moved back in hopes of reestablishing my home in Austin, but my timing was bad. And after being alone in an apartment for a couple months, I started to lose my mind. And I made up this incantation that I would repeat to myself as a way to cheer myself up or remind myself that I have a future, which was, may my future be so epic and lovely as if to be divine. And I would say that over and over again. And I don't know, it just seemed like I found a way to work that into the novel. It's the last sentence of the first chapter, and it just seemed like a good title, and other people liked it too. So I went with that.
For your first book, you were asked what it takes to finish a novel, a process that can extend over several years, sometimes many years. You said the answer for you is obsession, mainly with a question you have in your life that you can only solve with fiction. What was the question for Epic and Lovely?
It wasn't really a question so much as like a duty I felt a need to fulfill. And we talked about this a little bit. To my knowledge, there is no work of fiction or even nonfiction that is told from the perspective or describing the experience of being the child of a much older father. It's not a common experience, but, you know, once in a while, the media picks up these stories and they try to put a positive spin on it because that's what they do. If you are out there and you had a father that was in his 60s when you were born and you had a great experience, I'm happy for you. That's not me. But it would just be kind of painful in some way to read these articles where they found like a 62-year-old guy with a toddler and they're having a great time. I'm like, yeah, I believe that. Come back in 15 years when that guy's in his late 70s and the child's a teenager. And you're going to be telling a different story. So, yeah, I was a teenager and I watched my dad die of dementia and old age. And that did something to me. So, I took it upon myself to write this novel with a character that had same experience as me because I want that book to be in the world.
Great.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Mo Davio, author of the new novel Epic and Lovely from West Virginia University Press. Mo will be launching the book in conversation with Tracy Manister at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village on Thursday, September 4th at 7 p.m. You can find out more about Mo, her work, and all her events online at modaviau.com. Just a note that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. We're in the first week of our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself, renewing your membership, or making a one-time contribution. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, September 11th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.